Back in the early days when I was sort of newly ordained, and after two or three years, I used to feel a bit of stress around Easter as to how do you tell such a familiar story in ways that are fresh each time. However, in my naivety, I realised that it isn't just a question of how can we bring a new spin, a new version to the Easter narrative, but more in particular, how can we draw on such an enormous banquet of truths to reflect upon? If you think about Easter, the story, it's like going into a table that has this whole range of treats and spreads, and you simply can't consume them all at once. There's so many different dimensions to what is happening upon the cross, what is happening in the resurrection. And if you're wise, you look ahead and you realise that you have to pace yourself. You know, sometimes when you have those smorgasbord meals and you get overwhelmed with the first two or three and you pile your plate up and you realise, oh, hang on, my favourite treat's a bit further down the line. Well, it's sort of like that a little bit with our feasting upon the truths of Easter. Just to change the image a bit, we may have noticed that there's an election on at the moment. You may have noticed. And when I get a little bit bored occasionally with some of the speak that comes through the things, I try and pick the phrases that are on each party's talking sheets for each day. Because you know how it works. Each day, early in the morning, the party has a talking sheet that goes out to all their different members and others, and they all have to hit the same phrase. And I try and pick up what is today's phrase, and you begin to hear it over Western Australia, and you hear the same thing happening up in Queensland and the same thing happening locally, and you think, I think they're all talking off the same talking sheet. One of the interesting things about the Easter narrative is that it is not all off the one sheet. While there are some common truths and affirmations, and he is not here, he is risen, is central to it, there's a significant diversity of ways in which the account was experienced. And for some would say that's actually a sign that it's not to be trusted. You've got a distinctive account, some details in Matthew and other details in Mark and other details in Luke, and John's different again. And some had said, oh, that's a sign that there's no common agreement around the details. Most reporters or historians, pretty much the same in some ways, would actually say, if you go and interviewed a whole range of witnesses and they gave you word-for-word account the same, you would think, that's a bit suspicious. If I'm hearing exactly the same lines from everyone, there's probably been some prior collusion going on. But if you go out and speak to different witnesses who give different perspectives on things that have happened, that's adding to your range of the different notions, the different ways in which it was experienced. So, I'm going to push my luck and try for a third image this time. Imagine that we were a drone hovering over Jerusalem on that Easter morning. And we could see all these different things happening in different areas. One group running around one path around by the walls here. Another group coming over from Bethany. And another group coming a little bit later by another route again towards the grave. You would actually see a lot of things happening. And the experience that those different parties who visited the tomb, what they experienced actually was their experience. It's just that it didn't all happen at one moment, at one time. And once we begin to read the gospel accounts that way, we begin to see that Matthew gives the account through one household's experience when they heard the news and when they were beginning to visit, or they made the visit to the tomb. And that was different from the household who came from Bethany. And that was different from those who had actually been staying in the house where the upper room was, probably John Mark's house. And we realise that those different experiences just give us glimpses into the enormity of an event. So today, rather than looking at the big drone picture and trying to trace all the different things happening at once, we're going to zoom down onto just one account in Luke's gospel. It follows the experience of one of those parties and through a couple, two or three of those eyes in particular. Now, first of all, in Luke, he's been writing a narrative around all these events. And on Good Friday, we read our way through Luke chapter 23 and our various reflections upon the cross. And this year, we've been looking at Luke's gospel in particular. A couple of features that we didn't have time to really dwell on Friday, I wanted to highlight at this stage, because the crucifixion as an act of execution for criminals, as we mentioned on Friday, was reserved just for the lowest of the low. You want to put it in terms of the Roman power, it is for those who want to be pushed under the Roman thumb as low as it gets. Crucifixion was reserved for those people. For the Jewish leaders, it wasn't so much pushing people down, but more pushing people out. So for the Jewish leaders, it was pushing them outside the city, the presence, the home of God, and being told that there is no place for you here inside the city. You are outside the camp. You are unclean. You are unworthy to be within the city of God. But Jesus broke the script a little bit around how executions, how crucifixion was designed to work. Part of the Roman art form of crucifixion was to prolong it as long as possible, sometimes even up to 2 or even 3 days. And the way in which it was actually designed, and even the way that was hung on the cross, was not to enable someone to die too quickly. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And when he had said this, he breathed his last. Jesus gave up his life. That is to say, he made a choice. He wasn't subject to that prolonged agony upon the cross. He was an actor who said, "This is the moment, this is the time." And with that, he breathed his last. There's another element in which the gospel narrative said that even crucifixion would not define Jesus, and that is the burial. For the Romans, their preference would be to allow the body to be thrown into a public pit and be succumbed to the birds and the animals that would come. There were exceptions, and Jesus was one of those exceptions. So as we imagine that moment, almost like when all the ammunition has been spent, the evil has been poured out upon Jesus, the injustice, the corruption, the darkness, the horror has been thrown at Jesus until there's nothing left. In that stillness, there's a profound moment where God has things in his hands. We're told the body of Jesus was taken down and treated respectfully and with care. Fiona and I were reflecting on that yesterday, just how precious it is to know that the body of Jesus did not succumb to being thrown into the wasteland and subject to the birds and the animals who would come. That Joseph of Arimathea went to Pilate and gave the permission to take the body and to place it in a tomb. And not just any tomb. There was a good and righteous man named Joseph, Luke tells us, a member of the Sanhedrin, part of the religious leadership team, the elite, who had not agreed with their plan and action. He was from Arimathea, means the hill country up in Galilee, a Judean town, in Judea. And he was looking forward for the kingdom of God. He approached Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Taking it down, he wrapped it in fine linen and placed it in a tomb cut into the rock where no one had ever been placed. It was actually a really precious sight to be able to have a tomb in a prized part of the area just outside Jerusalem, let alone one that had not yet to be used. They were reused by families for generations and generations. There, Jesus' body was laid with respect. And I think Luke wants us to know that, And so the account that we had this morning, it was the preparation day. The Sabbath was about to begin. The women who had come with him from Galilee followed along and observed the tomb and how his body was placed. Then they returned and prepared spices and perfumes. John's Gospel tells us it was a lot, abundance of the spices and perfumes. And they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. I wonder how they felt when they were preparing the spices. You know those moments, we all have them eventually, of grief, shock, we're trying to process information and we just try to do things around the home, do some jobs. Here we have the women preparing the perfumes, the spices, spending the day just beginning to that, to purchasing before the Sabbath of what was needed for these things. On the first day of the week, that is the Sunday, very early in the morning, they came to the tomb bringing the spices they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. They went in, but they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. In Luke's account, all three of them went into the tomb, and the body was not there. One of them, Mary Magdalene, is highlighted in Mark's version, and she later has a personal encounter with Jesus afterwards. Luke doesn't include that in his account. And they were just wondering, what's happened? Has this the body been taken? Has Jesus been stolen? So as they were struggling with this, what is going on? It's a Messian account. It's a time in which it doesn't make sense. What is going on here? And Luke actually sits in that space, that confusion. What is going on? Trying to find an explanation how the body is empty. So while they were perplexed about this, Luke says, suddenly two men, we know them to be two angels, stood by them in dazzling clothes. So the women were terrified and bowed down to the ground. This moment in which heaven breaks upon earth into this moment is so overwhelming. They were terrified and bowed down to the ground. They still did not know what was going on. And then we have a text beginning to explain what is going on. Not the full details. Why are you looking for the living among the dead? Asked the men. He is not here, but he has risen. The words that change the direction of history. He's not in this tomb. The tomb is empty. He is risen. And then they went on to say, remember. Remember how he spoke to you when he was still in Galilee, saying it is necessary for the Son of Man, that's Jesus, be betrayed into the hands of sinful men, to be crucified and to rise on the third day. The words "it is necessary" means it is necessary for God's mission. If God's purpose and work of salvation and redemption is to happen, this needed to occur. Intriguingly, in Luke's gospel, it is the women who remembered. In a minute we go on to some of the males, the men. They couldn't believe it, couldn't make sense of it. Luke actually has been following these story of the women who followed Jesus right from the early days in Galilee. It is only now that Luke draws that thread together and names the three women who are also named back in Luke chapter 8. Returning from the tomb, they reported all these things to the 11 and to all the rest that were gathered. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary the mother of Jesus. Oh, James, sorry. Comes off. Mary the mother of James and the other woman. Now, if you think there's a lot of Marys in the New Testament, there are a lot of Marys in the New Testament. It's because Mary is the variation of Miriam, the sister of Moses. So it was a very popular name at that time for those reasons. But these three and the other women. So we actually know, even Luke says, yes, there were others there, and some of the other accounts come through their eyes. There's a good argument to be made that Luke's account has come from Joanna. He's one of the witnesses that he's interviewed. Joanna has another variation of her name. It is Junia. And we can't be 100% sure, but it's very likely that Joanna becomes Junia, the apostle that Luke mentions, Paul mentions in Romans 16. But these three, Luke says, they got it. They remembered. Jesus had actually been trying to tell us. We just didn't understand what he was saying. But now it all makes sense. So they go and report it. But as they come to the rest, where they were gathered now, and most likely in the upper room, but these words seemed like nonsense to them, and they did not believe the women. Peter, however, did believe enough. Not a saving faith, but enough to get up and to run to the tomb. And when he stooped to look in, he saw only the linen cloths. So he went away, amazed at what had happened. Now, in Luke's account at this stage, they hadn't encountered the risen Jesus. That emerges a little bit later in Mark, a little bit later in different ways in Matthew and in John. But Luke wants to stay with the first historical fact, is that the tomb was empty. Lots of people came to investigate it, to check it out, saying, this can't be true. Look, we'll show you where the body is. The tomb was empty for all of Jerusalem to come to investigate. As a historian, there's a great consensus that that is one of the truths that is foundational. Now, we do know that at a later stage, when Jesus appeared, he appeared only to those who had faith, not to the wider public. But I want to stay with that space of where we are at this stage. So we have the first amazing reality is the facts. The tomb was empty. Now, as Luke's account continues, he goes on to the road to Emmaus with Cleopas and a companion, possibly Cleopas's wife, and they encountered the risen Jesus, and then more and more people began to encounter the risen Jesus, and the wider truth becomes. But first there's this amazing reality, the facts of the empty tomb, and then the accounts of people coming and encountering Jesus. And then in time came understanding, and the heart of the gospel message began to take shape and to focus. Not just he is risen, but all that that signifies by way of the whole mission and ministry that promises the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus is now presented in that space. So we're actually going to do a bit of all that at St. Matthew's. The Easter season continues until Pentecost, and we're going to ride it out. So while the commercial Easter is almost over and you can go and get all your sales tomorrow or wherever it is that you go and find the sales, Easter is commencing today, and we're going to celebrate the season of Easter right through until Pentecost. We're going to have that greeting, Christ is risen, he is risen indeed, every Sunday between now and Pentecost. And we're going to explore a few more of those offerings, those meals on the banquet table. As the early church began to try and make sense of what was happening, what does this mean? And they began to realize it meant a lot. So we're going to explore what does it mean for us personally? What does it mean for us as a church? What does it mean for the whole world? And what does it mean for all creation? The first fruits of the resurrection. There is so much more that we'll explore in coming weeks. But for now, let's just stay with that space of none of us have got it all worked out. All of us have got questions. But what we begin to glimpse, what we begin to see is truly life-giving. It is where hope and light prevails, where the love of God reflected in the sacrifice of his Son becomes the source, the fount of an enormous movement of grace. Our world, as at all times, needs to rediscover the richness of grace over against other narratives of vengeance and enmity and fear and suspicion. Let's live in this season, let us be a people of Easter. Amen.